Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Ross, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. This panel of the court has six cases on its calendar today, and two of which were previously argued to the court in the courtroom. And now we are switching to a Zoom format for the third case at the request of one of the parties. I want to apologize to the attorneys and to anyone in the gallery for being behind schedule. The first two arguments took a little bit longer than expected, and then we had some small technical difficulties, which have been sorted out. So I apologize for the delay, but we are not ready. And of course, it will not affect the time that we allocate to the third case. So I will call the case. It's case number A21-1574, Lisa Falk versus One Call Medical, Inc. I assume counsel are familiar with our general procedures, which are essentially the same in the Zoom format. Each party will have 15 minutes for the principal argument, and then relator will have an opportunity for rebuttal. So counsel for relator, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thank you. My name is Christine Tuft, and I represent the relator appellant, Lisa Falk, in this matter. The principal issue that we're presenting to the court is whether the ULJ, the unemployment law judge, committed legal error in determining the period of time for which Ms. Falk was ineligible for unemployment compensation benefits, and then secondarily committed legal error in calculating any overpayment that may be due in this matter. And as the position of Ms. Falk that errors were committed in both of those questions. So just a little background for this matter. I know the court has the appellate briefs in this case, but Ms. Falk began her employment with One Call in April of 2016. As of April 6th of 2020, close to the start of the pandemic, she was told that she was being furloughed from her position. And at that point, she did apply for and began receiving unemployment compensation. Subsequently, on about July 3rd.
Ms. Tuft, I'm going to interrupt you because I think all three judges are familiar with the facts. But let me maybe focus in on some of the most important facts. So is there the last day of her employment was August 3rd, correct? Is there any evidence in the record that she signed the agreement on a date after August 3rd?
Your Honor, she testified at the hearing that she was not sure what date she signed the agreement. What she knew was that she signed it at some point in August that was too late for her severance to begin until the next pay period. But she said that she docu-signed it and she did not have a copy of that.
And well, perhaps there's a distinction between the date that she signed it and the date that she submitted it or returned it to the company. Is there any evidence about making that distinction?
No, Your Honor. My answer to that question would be the same. That she indicated that whatever day she docu-signed it was the date that she would have returned it to the company, but she did not have that information when she presented her case to the ULJ in this matter.
And what may be relevant under the statute is, I'm looking at the statute now, quote, the date the applicant first becomes aware that the employer will be making a payment, end quote. Was there any testimony by her about when she made the decision to sign, you know, when she knew in her own mind that she would be signing it?
Not exactly, Your Honor. And actually, I think you just quoted the portion of the statute that I think is the crux of the issue in this case. What she reported to the ULJ, you'll see it in the transcript, is that she did not know when she would be receiving payment. And she testified that she'd never been through the process before. She didn't know how it worked. She didn't know when she should expect payment, other than what's, you know, quoted in the record is that the severance agreement apparently says something to the effect that it'll be as of the 16th date after the date that she signs it, and wherever that falls within their next pay period. So what she told the employment compensation judge, and what we think is relevant in this matter, is that she did not know when she would be receiving payments. She didn't know what to expect. She didn't know, you know, how the process worked or anything in that regard. So that's why we think that that particular language in the statute is very relevant. You know, as it indicates that she becomes ineligible the later of one of two dates, the date of separation or the date that she became aware that the employer will be making payment. And so, I mean, I think that that becomes the crux of it. You know, the department in its brief argues that she was aware that they would be making payment when she was told that she would be receiving a severance package. And we respectfully disagree with that interpretation of the statute. You know, knowing that your company is going to offer you a severance package sometime in July, and without having seen the documents and not having signed the documents, is not the equivalent of knowing when your company is going to be making the payment. So we really do think that that's the crux of the issue in this matter. And, you know, it's the position of Ms. Falk that at no time until she actually received the payment did she know that they were going to be making the payment, again, because she wasn't given a specific date. She testified to that. The ULJ found that her testimony was credible. He found that she was forthright and honest in her answer, and that her answers were in line with the evidence submitted in this case. And so,
Ms. Tufts, can I ask you, is separation from employment the same as termination?
Well, I'm actually not. The term used in this matter was separation from employment. She was told that she was going to be permanently laid off, is what she was told. And that's what she testified to in this matter. So to me, those probably all fall under the same type of definition. She was
Just to clarify, so that's the August 3rd date. Even though her last day of actually working there was the furlough, I guess it was described as was correct. In April, but termination and separation, you consider those synonymous as we're looking at the statutory provision at August 3.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Ms. Tufts, I'm looking at page 12 of your brief, and there are two paragraphs in the middle of the page. At the end of the second one, there's a sentence that begins with, instead, relator is asking this court to find that she became ineligible starting the date her check was meant to cover, pay period starting August 17, 2020. Wait, how under the statute do we get to that date?
Well, Your Honor, honestly, it is an attempt by Ms. Falk to try to understand the statute in this case and to not attempt to obtain double payments, because that was never her intention in this matter. And again, you know, the ULJ found that she was honest and forthright in this case. When she received the check, which she received her first severance check in the record documents, it was received September 4th. It did indicate that it was for the pay period beginning August 17th. So her position in this matter is that is essentially when she knew that she was going to be paid, but she doesn't want, and she's not seeking double payments of any type. She's not attempting to double dip at all in this matter. She acknowledges that she received unemployment benefits for those periods after August 17th. And she has acknowledged that she's not entitled to double payment. for that period. It's really the periods before that for which the department is seeking reimbursement that we think awarding reimbursement for those periods is inconsistent with the statute and the statutory intent.
But if, I mean, I think it's your position that she didn't know that she was going to get paid until she actually got paid.
Correct.
And that happened on September 4.
Correct.
So why would we look at August 17?
Well, right. And I mean, you know, obviously Ms. Falk, you know, would like us and would say that she didn't know that until September 4th. But again, just in trying to be reasonable and not trying to have double payment in this matter, acknowledging that the severance pay says it was for that period of August, beginning August 17th, you know, that's why she has indicated that she understands that she may have to reimburse for that period of time. But certainly her ultimate position is she didn't know until she actually received the money that she was being paid and for what pay periods it would be for.
It wasn't her testimony that she didn't know when they would cut the check. I mean, in other words, it wasn't so much about whether she would get severance pay, but when she would receive the severance pay.
I think her testimony was that she was unclear about how the process would work and when she would ultimately be paid, correct?
I think it's when. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, whether or when?
I can look at the transcript, Your Honor, to be perfectly clear on it, but I believe that she said that she was unclear on the process and she did not know when she would be paid.
Right. When? That was my recollection. I'm sorry, Judge Ross, go ahead.
Well, I was going to move to the second issue. Your brief asks us to draw a conclusion about the amount of overpayment to make a correction, regardless of the first argument, the first issue. And you argue for sort of a lack of a tax consequence or withholding consequence. I'm going to pause for a minute because I think we just lost Judge Slater.
No, he's sorry, gone. I'm back. Thank you.
So I don't see any real legal argument in your brief on that point and no citation to any authority for your view that we should correct this or treat this as an error. Based upon your client's choice of withholding. So maybe you can supply the legal authority and make the legal argument or the logical argument as to why it is the correction should be made as you contend.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have any specific legal authority on that issue. My client...
What's the logic of it? I mean,
the logic of it is from her position, she had taxes withheld and, you know, agreed upfront to have the taxes withheld so that the amounts that she actually received are not the same as the amounts that it's reflected.
Right, but it's still her money. I mean, it's still hers. I mean, regardless of whether it's being withheld essentially in trust by the government but until the tax consequence is determined, why, as a matter of basic accounting, would we treat the calculation the way you're suggesting?
Your Honor, I understand your position and your question, and it's really my client being, like I indicated, frustrated with the process and the fact that she did have the taxes withheld and the belief that should be accounted for.
Understood. I gather you're conceding there's no legal support or logical support for that position.
As I indicated, I concede I don't have legal support.
Thank you.
So I see that I just have a few minutes left. I don't know if the court has any additional questions. And I do think that I have covered most of you know, what I would like to present on behalf of the client in this matter. But, you know, as indicated, you know, this woman felt that she was straightforward with the department. The judge found that she was honest and straightforward. She is not attempting and has never attempted to receive double compensation for any periods of time. She did not know when the payment was going to be issued, and therefore she believes that there's legal error in the award as issued by the department. And I can end at this point and thank you, and I'll just save my final comments for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tuft. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your clients and begin your argument. And I will note that the court did receive your notice of substitution of counsel, which was filed this morning. I believe at least this judge has received it. I'm not sure if the court has received it and I have seen it. But anyway, if you could please introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Good morning, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Lawson Allen. I represent Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, the respondent in this matter. There are two questions for the court to determine. The first, whether Deed committed legal error by establishing a period of ineligibility related to the relator's receipt of severance payment effective the week of August 2nd. And two, whether Deed miscalculated the amount overpaid to the respondent. In addressing those legal issues, the court should look at the amended determination, the amended request for reconsideration issued on November 29th, 2021. Deed was within its authority to amend legal errors prior to the appellation of this issue to the court.
Excuse me, Mr. Allen, do you mean, I think you said November 29, do you mean November 19?
I do, I misspoke, thank you.
Okay, please proceed.
And that is the determination or decision the court has jurisdiction to review. That's determined by 268.18. And that effective date of that issue is August 2nd. And the overpayment amount is $4,400. Deed gets at the effective week of August 2nd by analyzing the statute. And there are two triggering dates in determining when to apply payment received because of, upon, or after separation. Those dates are either the latter of the separation date or the latter of when the applicant is informed the employer will make the payment. In this issue, there seems to be no dispute that the applicant was presented with eligibility for severance on July 13th. There is also no dispute that the applicant separated or was discharged from the employment on August 3rd. The triggering date then is the latter of those two conditions, the discharge date, August 3rd. Severance should be and is in the request for reconsideration answer applied to the period immediately following the latter of those two dates, starting August 4th, 2020. Deed's interpretation of the statute and application of this issue is not a requiring that the payment be made or that the applicant have received or signed a severance agreement. The requirement or triggering of the event is that the applicant is informed. The applicant knows that the employer will make a payment. Deed argues that in this case, the applicant knew that on July 13th when she received severance paperwork information, right? Potential severance receipt. With respect to the overpayment, there's no dispute that the applicant received unemployment benefits for each week beginning August 2nd through the week beginning September 9th. The relator's brief gets to the tax question, and I'll address that briefly. The department does not treat optional tax withholdings as not benefits paid. The department is not the custodian of those tax withholdings. They are reported and delivered to the respective revenue federal or state. The department considers those paid to the applicant. The applicant's remedy, if ultimately determined overpaid on employment benefits, ineligible for those, comes at tax season. The court's questions indicate it has firm grasp on the mechanics of that. This applicant received weekly unemployment benefits each week, August 2nd through August 9th, then stopped requesting to receive unemployment benefits. The department considers the applicant overpaid $4,400 for that period. It gets there by multiplying the applicant's weekly benefit amount of $740 by six. It is accurate that the department withheld 50% of the applicant's weekly benefit amount for the weeks of August 30th and August 6th. It did so pursuant to the initial determination on this matter dated September 23rd. The department has authority to offset weekly benefit payments to satisfy determined overpayments under 268.18. The applicant's actual amount owed is not the $4,400. The department considers that the amount the applicant was overpaid because the department considers the offsets an overpayment because those monies do go to satisfy an outstanding debt. The department does not argue that the applicant owes $4,400. The department's position is that she was overpaid $4,400 in unemployment benefits.
Mr. Allen, I have to say I'm a little bit confused by this argument by the department, because looking at page 17 of your brief, you say the outstanding overpayment balance is $3,700. And then the brief also says the overpayment amount of $4,400 is correct, but does not account for the two offsets of $740. I just don't see how those statements can be reconciled. I guess you just made a distinction between overpayment and amount owed. Are those two distinct terms that are defined differently in the statute? I mean,
I don't think it's unique to UI law, Your Honor. The actual overpayment is $4,400. However, the department used unemployment benefits towards the satisfaction of that overpayment. So the outstanding amount is the $3,700. The department took 50% of Ms. Flack's benefit payments for the week of August 30th and September 6th. It applied those to the outstanding overpayment determined by the September 23rd determination. So the
I might see it your way if there was at one time an outstanding balance of $4,440, and then at a later time, offsets were made or somehow money was subtracted or was taken away from her. But that's not what happened. I mean, the offset occurred. I mean, there were six weekly payments, and the two offsets occurred in conjunction with the fifth and the sixth payment, fifth and the sixth benefit payment, correct?
That is correct.
So the balance never got to $4,440. It never got that high.
That is correct. The balance was never that high. The reason why the fifth and sixth weeks in the period of question were used to offset is because the initial determination covered a shorter period.
Well, I understand. I'm not saying why. I'm not questioning the department's authority to make the offsets. I'm questioning the statement that the overpayment amount of $4,440 is correct. I don't think it was correct. When it was made in November of 2021, it was incorrect. Seems to me. I don't see how you can say it was correct.
The department's position is that while Ms. Flack never received $4,400 paid to her in unemployment benefits, $4,400 were paid from the trust fund towards Ms. Flack's satisfaction of an overpayment. It paid to her $740 for each of those calendar weeks in question.
But it didn't. It paid it. It did for four, but it didn't for the fifth and the sixth.
It used 50% of the benefit payment towards an existing debt.
Is the term overpayment defined in the statute? And if so, could you point it out to me?
It is not statutorily defined.
Okay. Well, would it be an error for this court? Let's say if we were to agree with you on the first issue, would it be an error for this court to say that the overpayment amount of $4,440 was not the amount owed on November 2021, is not the amount owed today, and that the, you know, the Court of Appeals opinion should reflect that the net overpayment at the moment is $3,700, and we would affirm the decision of the ALJ as modified?
It would be an error. The deed argues that the overpayment of $4,400 is correct. Deed argues also that the net owed is $3,700. Deed considers the $4,400 paid to Ms. Flack the respondent this issue. It it recognizes that $740 of that $4,400 was used to satisfy the gross overpayment. The net owed is $3,700, but Deed argues that it's accurate that she was paid $4,400 in unemployment benefits she is ineligible for.
You may proceed or sum up.
In summary, Deed argues that the November amended request for reconsideration is legally correct. The severance payment is appropriately applied to the period, in this case, following separation. Deed gets there because it argues the applicant was notified of the employer's intent to pay severance prior to the separation. The latter of those two triggering events is where we begin the application of the severance payment towards eligibility. Deed argues that the applicant was paid six times a weekly benefit amount of $740, resulting in a gross overpayment of $4,440. Deed argues that the net overpayment is $3,700. Deed argues the unemployment law judge's decision should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Ms. Tuft, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just very quickly, turning back to the dates, the relevant dates in this matter, the department would have this court interpret the law to be that if an employer tells an employee that they will be offered a severance package, that is the equivalent of the date the applicant became aware that the employer will be making a payment under the statutory provision that is at issue here, 268085 subdivision 3B. It is our position that those two things are not equivalent. Knowing that you're going to be offered a severance package is not the same as knowing that you're going, that your employer is going to be making a payment. And there is no evidence in this matter other than Ms. Falk's own testimony, and it's Falk, not Flack, just for clarification with the court. There's no evidence other than her own testimony that she did not know when they were going to be issuing the payment regarding that issue. And therefore, it is our position to hold her to a standard that somehow being offered or being told she's going to be offered a severance package is the same as knowing that payment will be issued is not a proper interpretation of the statute. The department's interpretation, if accurate, given the fact that she didn't get any pay on the severance until September, would have left Ms. Falk without any income for the entire month of August, effectively saying she separated August 3rd. Sorry, we don't know when you might be paid. You weren't paid till September, and she would have been left without payment for the entire month of August. And just also, you know, in summary, I think it's a little bit ironic here that the department wants to take this position against a, you know, a lay person who admitted in her testimony that she was not familiar with this process at all, when the department itself, the experts on this topic, have issued 5 different numbers in this matter for the alleged overpayment, starting with the first letter from the department itself, 3 different numbers and dates from the ULJ in this matter, and then a brief filed in this Court of Appeals matter providing a 5th number. So Ms. Falk did not know that she was going to be paid until she received the check in September. And we believe that the overpayment as calculated by the department is incorrect in both the number of weeks and the amounts claimed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tuff. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is deemed submitted and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. That wraps up the final case on our oral argument calendar today. So the court is now in recess.